Hello, it worked.
It worked, it connected. Now, before we do anything else, give us the last name.
Shorty, so Seba.
Okay, very good. Well, welcome to my podcast, A Life and Biography. This is actually episode 61. I've been doing this now for over a year, and I've had some wonderful guests and biographers. And I thought we'd start by your telling us a little bit about yourself, and how you got interested in Ethel Rosenberg.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a great honor to talk to you. How did I get involved in Ethel? There's the short answer and the long answer. I'll try and connect them. So I started life as a foreign correspondent for Reuters, and in 1978, they decided in their wisdom when I was pregnant that actually the life of a foreign correspondent and a mother were incompatible. So they let me go, I think is the phrase we'd use today. And as it happens, I went to live in New York at that point. And with more time on my hands than I'd ever had, I indulged in a lot of reading of American literature. And one of the books, and I still have the falling apart paperback copy of it, was E.L. Doctorow's The Book of Daniel, which is a highly fictionalized version of the Rosenberg drama, fictionalized to the extent that instead of orphaning two boys, the death of both parents in the novel, they become the two sons become a son and a daughter. Well, I was shortly to be the mother of a son and a daughter. So this story really stuck in my mind. That's 42 years ago. And I suppose when I was looking for a new subject after my most recent book, which was called Les Parisiennes about women in wartime Paris, and the publishers said to me, well, what about writing a biography of a spy? I couldn't think of a spy in Paris who hadn't already had a good biography. But I realized that here was a woman accused of being a spy. Maybe there was another version of events. It was coming up to 70 years. That's critical, in my view, not because I'm so crazy about anniversaries, but because I thought if there was going to be anyone alive who remembered Ethel in the 1950s, I had to work fast. And I was lucky to that extent because I found two women in their 90s who remembered Ethel. And of course, her two sons are still alive. They were 10 and 6 at the time of the electrocution, and they're now in their 70s, retired college professors. So that's really how I got interested in it.
Well, it always interests me to ask biographers how they got interested in the subject or how they got interested in biography. I have yet to have a guest on this podcast who says, "Oh, I grew up wanting to be a biographer."
Well, no, that's you're not going to get me saying that. I grew up wanting to be a journalist, and I was so thrilled to work at Reuters and thought that I would have a career covering wars all over the world. And when that was cut short, I think actually they did me a favor by allowing me to write books and having had what I think is the most extraordinary training in my 6 or 7 years at Reuters. I think I could then apply it to work as a biographer. One of the things that I remember most of all is that you mustn't draw any conclusion without two pieces of evidence. So that's one of the things that I remember. The other is that I absolutely love mixing interviews with real live people, which is my journalistic training. But of course, you have to have the documents and the archives as well. The two go together. So I think I've been lucky by having 20th century figures, or at least those are the figures I've chosen, because I love being able to mix the two. And I think you have a very different result when it's not just the fact that I don't really like sitting alone all day long in libraries and archives. I know you have to do it, but any excuse to find real people and I'll jump on a plane or train or whatever it takes to catch them.
Well, that's exactly what happened to me. I was trained as a literary and I was thinking of writing a book. My first biography was of Marilyn Monroe, and I spent the summer reading the literature. I was supposed to write a book that was going to be a kind of academic study, that is everything that had been written about Marilyn Monroe. And I really got impatient for a number of reasons, which I don't have to go into now, but it suddenly occurred to me that I knew a couple of people in Marilyn Monroe's world, and that just excited me. To bring someone's life off of the page, so to speak, and have it again in the recollections of other people. That's really one of the hooks, I think, of biography. It's also what, for some writers, put biography. In other words, especially academics, they love that fixed, you know, word on the page. They like working with letters, and so do I. The idea of suddenly dealing with a living force, a person, so to speak, makes it much more, I would say, protean. You know, it's just so energizing, at least for me.
Well, I absolutely agree. I think we both believe you need both. You can't just base a life on a series of interviews. But I think one of the most rewarding experiences for me is, because of necessity, the people you're interviewing are old. If you can find old people who haven't told their story before, that's wonderful. The problem with many old people is that they have told these stories and they're sort of fixed in a particular way, and getting them to budge off that fixed version that they have is difficult. But I think I've often been lucky to find people who haven't told their stories. And most old people, I would say, as they reach the end of their lives, want somehow to make sense of it. Now, you could say they're using a narrative arc to make sense of it, or they're telling it in a way that they want you to believe. But I don't believe that's always the case, because these aren't necessarily people in the public eye. They're often private individuals. And in trying to make sense of your life, it's a basic need, I think, as you reach the end of it. And I think that's just such a privilege and an excitement to meet people who want to share with you after 60, 70 years, how they have the prism through which they now view the events of long ago. And, you know, often if they've had a key event of a war or losing virginity or something at 19 or 20, that's very clearly etched in their minds, whereas what they did to go shopping yesterday might not be.
Oh, I agree. And also, meeting with that particular witness, and you've come to that witness because you have a documents. You have other ways of judging, you know, this person's recollection. So it's never just the interview. I'm going to do a podcast about this later. It's going to sound a little academic, but I'm going to be talking about biography and what I call the hermeneutic circle, the part and the whole, how you understand the part, your sense of the whole, and how you understand the whole from the parts that you collect. That's a subject for another podcast.
Yes, I can see. And I really don't want to give the impression that I have not used many documents and archives which have come out in the last 20 or so years and which weren't available at the time. I think you also have to have an overall view of your subject, and I do, and see if these documents add new information. But I'm absolutely not trying to make the case for no documents or archives. It's the mixture.
Sure, yeah. People want us to talk about Ethel Rosenberg for sure. There's some people listening into this podcast. So how do you even get started? I mean, I know there are documents, I know there are interviews, but for you, yourself, what were the first steps? When you decided you were going to write about Ethel Rosenberg?
Well, I read all the secondary information as much as I could. As you'll know, you have to write a proposal to your publisher. I think even if you're A1 famous, marketing departments want to know that they're dealing with a book that's saleable. So I probably spent about 6 months looking at all the information online, the secondary sources, and writing a proposal. And my publishers needed to consider it, whether there was, in fact, anything new. What was new, in a way, is that nobody had separated Ethel from Julius. And I found that very early on. As soon as I spoke to people who thought they were very familiar with this figure, they would say to me, oh, you mean the Rosenbergs, the spies. That was a sort of Pavlovian reaction. So I knew that there was a case to be made. They were very different people. Julius, very definitely, according to the released information, was a spy recruiter. Ethel, very definitely, did not have a code name, was not dealing with the KGB. It's not a crime to have thoughts. It's not a crime to have knowledge. So, you know, where between those legal principles did Ethel come out? And I knew that would be a fascinating, nuanced study, and I needed to keep away from the extremes, because extremism doesn't solve an argument, and I can keep more than one idea in my head. She can be a communist and not necessarily guilty. She could even be guilty to a degree, but suffering a trial that was a miscarriage of justice. All these things I was thinking about at the beginning. So it was an intellectual exercise. And what happened was I sent the proposal to the publishers. They decided they really would like to look at it, look at an old and well-known story in this new way. And they issued a statement that went out on some bookseller's website, whereupon, of course, I heard from the two Rosenberg sons, who are now called Mirapol, that's their adopted name. And I hadn't wanted that. I had wanted to approach the sons and tell them before it was a done deal. So sure. I started off with them on the back foot. I did not want it to be an authorized biography. I did not think that was the way I wanted to proceed. But I wanted their acknowledgement, because, of course, I thought they could be helpful. So I immediately apologized that it had been announced before I'd spoken to them. I just felt it was a lack of good manners, if nothing else. And because I live in London and they're both in, well, one lives in Northampton and the other in Cold Spring. And so I just hopped on a plane and hoped they would see me. And the first meeting was professional and businesslike, and I was very worried they would think, you know, how on earth can an English woman possibly get to grips with this story? And I hope by the end they believe that, and this is a 5-year process, they believe that actually, as an English woman, I've come to it without an agenda, with a different attitude. So over the 5 years, I've probably seen them 4 times. We've now done many Zoom calls. They did introduce me to Ethel's psychotherapist, who was 95 when I saw her. She's still alive at 99 and lives in California. And one of the most inspiring, sharp people. And I really feel indebted for that introduction. But otherwise, this is my book. So that's how I got started. There's just a lot of documentation, not really enough live people for me, as given what I've just said to you, to interview. I also met a woman called Miriam Moskowitz, who'd been in prison with Ethel. So that was valuable. And, you know, it's really just a question of studying all the available documentation. Yes, and many, many other books written about the subject.
Yes, of course, yeah. In listening to what you're saying about how you approach the book, one of the things you're saying to us is you're not prosecuting a case. And I don't know how many reviews you've received so far. You know, I wrote one in the San Francisco Chronicle. I like the openness of your book and allowing the reader to draw certain conclusions, but I expect, and whether you've got any reviews like this or not, there are always some reviewers who have judgment, you know, who want the biography to be definitive for you to whatever it is you think of Ethel Rosenberg when you're narrative and you're constructing a biography, at least this is how I see it. That's really your job. You're not ducking any of the issues. You're presenting all the evidence in life story, but it's not up to you finally to say, well, here's my moral judgment, or here's my political judgment,
This is balm to my ears, because I believe you have to remain open to the nuances. You don't know their pillow talk. I think it is absolutely clear that Ethel knew and approved of what Julius was doing, but it's not a crime to have thoughts. You know, it's not a crime to have knowledge. And so you're absolutely right. I'm not trying to relitigate the trial. I am telling a story. I feel very proud to be Ethel Rosenberg's storyteller and to reconstruct her life, a complicated life in the 1950s, trying to be a loyal housewife, trying to be a good mother, and a supportive wife. All those things, I think, mattered to her much more than being a doctrinaire communist. But if somebody who knew her has an impression of her as being a doctrinaire communist, I didn't want to suppress that quote, but some people say, you know, you're absolutely right. A reviewer thinks, well, I haven't got a clear view, because on the one hand, I'm saying somebody thought she was a doctrinaire communist. On the other hand, I can see that communism was not her prime focus. And so, you know, where do I stand? I tell you exactly where I stand, that I think a complicated person like Ethel, and arguably flawed, but aren't we all flawed, can actually be both those things at once. And you're so right. I fear, be reviewed according to people's preconceptions of the case, preconceptions of whether someone who was a communist in those times and believed in supporting Soviet Russia should therefore be punished. And, you know, my view is, for goodness sake, let's step back. Let's try and understand that, you know, no arguments are won by killing Ethel a second time over. It's extraordinary, really.
Yes. You talked about wanting to separate Ethel from Julius as obviously a separate human being with her own ideas and feelings. One of the, to me, powerful aspects of your book is you're looking at Ethel as a mother and her interest in psychology, which is not something a communist or someone with communist principles or in Marxism would necessarily tolerate or have interest in. Maybe you could say something more about that, her whole sort of connection with modern psychology, really.
Yes, it is really interesting, isn't it? I mean, Ethel, should we go back a bit, left school at 15, a very bright girl who skipped a class, wanted to go to college, but it was the Depression. Her mother insisted that she went out to work. She trained as a secretary because there was a younger son, the beloved David, who was the cause of all the trouble, who was still at school. So Ethel couldn't go to college, but she was the original autodidact. I mean, constantly trying to improve herself with very little money at her disposal with which to do that. So she took music lessons, she taught herself to sightsing. I mean, incredible determination getting hold of this secondhand piano and teaching herself and going back to face an audition for the Scuola Cantorum at Carnegie Hall a second time round, and joining the acting classes at settlement houses and winning a scholarship actually to the Clark House settlement. So continuing education after having been forced to leave school at 15, was something she was obviously determined to do. And we know she was bright and receptive. So I think psychology was part of her journey through life. She really wanted not only to be a good mother, but a driving force was to be a better mother than her own mother had been. Her own mother, Tessie, who had been probably jealous of seeing this bright daughter who was able to earn a living. Why, Tessie would argue, why was it necessary for women to be educated? All that mattered was the beloved David, that he should be educated. Girls really just had to get married and procreate. So Ethel wanted to distance herself all the time. And yet, as luck would have it, she was faced with her first child, Michael, born in 1943, intensely bright and clever, but challenging. And he didn't sleep. And you know, any of us who have had babies who don't sleep, it's exhausting. And you really try your best. And she wanted to feed him well and, you know, would run around the chair trying to pretend to be an animal. And then when his mouth was open, give him food. And she was, everything that motivated her, I think, was trying to be better than her own mother. And she was probably making some progress when her second child was born in 1947. So two children without much money in the house, and she hasn't got a job. And so the psychology, well, clearly she felt she was failing. So she needed some kind of psychiatric help for herself to understand. And she discovers Edith Buxbaum, who, you know, is not just any old person, but a Viennese emigre. I mean, absolutely right in the heart of the modern psychiatric movement. And she goes to mothering classes. I mean, not just mothering classes. She also goes to music classes because she was never allowed to follow that. And she thinks if she learns the guitar, perhaps she can teach Michael, and music is a solace. And then she's lucky enough to see this wonderful psychiatrist who I mentioned, Elizabeth Phillips, who is in California, who helps Michael with his problems. And having discussed this with Elizabeth Phillips, or Betty Phillips, as she's called, she believed that Ethel was on a journey and probably would have taken up psychology or psychiatry herself if she'd had a chance later on.
I think we're getting at part of why your book is titled An American Tragedy. There are tragic dimensions to this life. Didn't get fulfilled, so to speak.
Yeah, it's a Shakespearean tragedy in that the brother was the source of the only evidence, the perjured evidence that actually led to her death. I mean, the travesty of the trial, there are about five or six reasons I can give why it was a complete miscarriage of justice. And, you know, today she would never have been sent to her death. Even Julius should have been given what Klaus Fuchs in England was given, a maximum of 14 years imprisonment. But it is a tragedy for a life unfulfilled. I think that's how I see it. Just, you know, what would Ethel have given to society? And really, it's so painful to contemplate. Perhaps they took a wrong path. Perhaps they were vulnerable. I'm prepared to concede all of that. But nonetheless, you don't electrocute people for that misstep. And particularly, I'm going to focus on just Ethel. I want to leave Julius out of this because, as I've said, he was a spy. But Ethel was the bright one. Ethel was the one with so much to give. And the American dream was really within her grasp. Another mother who would have allowed her to go to college, or all sorts of what ifs come into this. So yes, I do see it as a real tragedy of a lost opportunity.
I think one thing said about Ethel Rosenberg is, look at her two sons. I mean, they were very young. I think you said 6 and 10?
Yes.
And what a traumatic event for these boys. And yet look at the lives they've led. I mean, they've overcome a good deal. And part of that has to be the attachment to the mother.
Yes, I've had this explained to me by various people who understand more about separation from both parents. I mean, it's not just losing the mother, it's losing both parents in the most vindictive circumstances and growing up thinking that your parents were traitors and loathed by the country that you're growing up in. And actually, well, you'll have read it. I mean, the chapter on the determination to institutionalize the boys after their parents' death is another extraordinary false step by the US authorities, but luckily they don't win through. And the redemption comes through this wonderful couple, Anne and Abel Mirapol, former communists, and a devoted set of parents, more devoted set would be hard to find. And somehow I think that this loving couple who gave them boundaries and didn't deny that their parents should be discussed, but on the other hand, you know, kept it in a, didn't overdo the martyrization of their parents. And so it's this wonderful loving couple. It's the fact that Ethel must have given an awful lot in those early years to their two sons, must have done. And the third thing is that they were very bright and very intelligent. And I think those three things together have created just wonderful sons who have led a very full and productive and giving life.
Yes. You know, there's a moment in your biography that I found absolutely astounding in terms of understanding the sort of the ethos, the mood of a time. And it's when Eisenhower, there are these appeals to Eisenhower to not go ahead with this execution. And he's worried about it because he's executing a mother of two boys. But then he falls back on this idea that somehow Ethel Rosenberg is, I don't think he ever says this, sort of the implication, she's unnatural and she's the ringleader. And when you think about that, Ethel Rosenberg, the leader of aspiring, where is the evidence?
It is, there is no evidence. I absolutely agree with you. It's, you know, we keep coming back to this word tragedy. And I suppose he felt he had to show strength to the communists. Yeah. It was a time of great hysteria. We haven't used the word McCarthy, but, you know, that's the shadow hanging over it. It was this terrible fear, an existential fear, actually, that America was under attack and he had to stand firm. But it's deep misogyny as well, the fact that Ethel was nearly 3 years older, therefore that was unnatural, that she must be the ringleader, the fact that she didn't show emotion during the trial indicated that she was strong and hard and unfeeling. And I think what I really have concluded is that, you know, Ethel came to symbolize somehow, and it was partly through the press and partly just through the ethos of the time. Ethel came to symbolize an attack on the whole American way of life. And that's why they felt, you know, if they're not going to show remorse and if they're not going to name names and confess, evil people like this simply have to be killed. And it is devastating.
Yes, I'm thinking now, and you mentioned in his book, Robert Coover's The Public Burning, that you have to have this public ritualized execution, so to speak, almost like you know, it's like the witch hunts. You're expunging evil from the community. You have to eradicate it. You can't just control it.
Yeah,
you have to completely destroy it.
Well, clearly, and by mentioning the Robert Coover book, boy, isn't that powerful reading?
Yes.
I mean, extraordinary. There were moments when I almost had to sort of force myself to read it, and other moments where I just found it totally compelling. But what you're saying is that in the 70 years since, this controversy hasn't gone away, and
no.
I'm finding it everything I knew but thought, oh, surely people will deal with this now in a calm way. It divides people in an extraordinarily vituperative, powerful way. I mean, she has become an American icon, which is what my last chapter is about. Not
yes.
only the Doctorow, the Robert Coover, there's a new book by Francine Prose about to appear, Angels in America, paintings and statues and postage stamps. I mean, Ethel really is the most extraordinarily powerful American icon for all sorts of reasons. She represented the American dream in her desires, and in her desire to use everything that America had to offer, but it was not to be. So it's a travesty of the American dream. I mean, it is very potent and very controversial still, which after 70 years is
yes.
some surprise.
There's one more writer that you mentioned in your book that we haven't talked about. And I want you to tell us why she's in the book. And that writer, you'll not be surprised, is of special interest to me, Sylvia Plath.
Yes, well, of course. I was leaving that for you. Well, along with people saying to me, oh, the Rosenbergs, they were spies, the other immediate sentence is the opening line of the Bell Jar. It was a queer, sultry summer, the summer they executed the Rosenbergs. I mean, what a line,
yeah.
Which someone else has used in their nonfiction memoir as well, Mary Cantwell. So obviously this, I've read this now another two times, and you know, Esther Ethel Greenwood is almost Esther Ethel Green Glass, and Sylvia Plath was having electroconvulsive therapy at the time, so burning along her nerves. I mean, the comparison is just unnerving. Well, that's probably not a very good metaphor, but you know what I mean.
I do.
Obviously, Sylvia Plath being in New York that summer couldn't help but reflect on this extraordinary story. But I'd love to hear what comparison you make and how the story informs the Bell Jar. It's the madness of America as well that she's seeing.
It is, and it's a narrator who feels isolated and persecuted in some ways, and who can't fully express herself. And so often the Bell Jar, and Sylvia Plath in general, is, I think people who haven't read her or haven't read much of her, thought of it as some kind of, you know, self-absorbed, suicidal, introverted, and in some cases will be regarded as a hysterical woman. And yet when you read the Bell Jar, it has such a sense of society, of the individual society. It's anything but self-absorbed. Yes, it's a first-person narrator. Yes, she has mental problems, but the way the novel is so often characterized is so reductionist. And what's good about what you do is you link her to Coover and to Rowe and these other writers who see the sort of the overarching significance of the case.
Well, how could I not? And she sees it with an enormous clarity. I mean, I felt she really took us back to that summer of madness in 1953, by which time, you know, there was a polarization. The clemency campaign had been late to get off the ground because of this extraordinary division within society at large, but the Jewish society had divided as well. And so I felt through Plath's eyes, you could really go there and feel it. And it's an extraordinarily sympathetic novel and a worrying novel. I mean, it doesn't leave you with a good feeling about how things are going to work out. But And the other person, of course, whom we haven't mentioned, I think I did say Angels in America, talking about plays, but Arthur Miller, of course, and The Crucible, which, yes. You know, he says was not deliberately written for the Rosenbergs, but audiences thought differently.
Yes, and it was in the air. You know, a writer yes. picks up on all sorts of things, whether the writer is conscious of it or not. You're part of, you know, a Weltanschauung worldview. And so these things, you know, indirectly and sometimes directly come seeping into the writer's work, I think.
Well, it's very clear. Of course, it was in the air. How could it not be, given what Hollywood was going through with hearings about being a communist? I mean, Julius faced his first loyalty hearing in 1941, when it wasn't illegal to be a member of the Communist Party. It was just a question of, you know, whether you were going to overthrow the government because of your belief. So he faced this loyalty hearing, and of course the whole chain of events disintegrates from that, because Ethel took the Fifth Amendment repeatedly during the trial, believing that it was dangerous to admit her communist sympathies, but actually, of course, it would have been much better if they had faced that openly and said, yes, I'm a communist, but no, I'm not a traitor. Because she was believed to be shifty and nobody could trust her because she kept taking the Fifth Amendment. So, you know, you can see this fear of communism is how it ultimately plays out with their electrocution.
Oh, yes, very much so. Facing the dilemma that, of course, a lot of other communists and ex-communists face at the same time, what to say about their own experience. And of course, in terms of politics, one can make all kinds of, you know, put judgments about this. But again, coming back to your book as a biography, you want to lay it open. You want to show people what the territory was, what her situation was, to identify with her in the sense of the way you almost identify with characters in a novel. It's not you say you identify with them that you like them or you dislike them, but you have some. You can put yourself in their place, or you begin to understand the whole constellation of personalities and history that goes into those individuals' actions.
Well, that's absolutely it. Self-identity with your subject is, as a more famous biographer than I has said, the first crime of the biographer. So I don't think I do that, but empathy is absolutely critical. Empathy and context, and hell, the responsibility. Ethel didn't ask me to write this book. Her son didn't ask me to write this book. I feel a huge sense of responsibility to tell her story as accurately as possible with all the information that is available and that I know. As you say, ultimately, the reader will make up their own minds. I can only lay out, here are the facts. And I think she really deserves this at the very least.
Oh, I agree. Yes, absolutely. And I think you show all of that in your book. Something I didn't ask you?
God, I'm sure there's an awful lot that you didn't ask me. What if Ethel were here, what would she do again? You know, would they be able to get a better lawyer? Would she have not taken the Fifth Amendment? Would she have smiled more in court? Would she have dressed better? I mean, they're such unfair questions. They couldn't get a better lawyer. They were lucky to have Manny Pop, yes. Who is a bit of a hero for me, I have to say. But, you know, they probably were ill-advised to an extent. They couldn't separate one from another in the clemency campaign. Is there anything else I want to say? Yeah, yes, I think I want to say that it's a love story as well, actually. I mean, unquestionably, Ethel loved Julius deeply. He was the first man who really admired her, who gave her courage that what she was doing was right, that her career could have been as a singer if they'd had any money, that she was making progress as a mother. And it was a physical love story. It's a story of barbarity as well. I mean, putting her in isolation in Sing Sing, and I've seen her cell. It's now used for other purposes. But, you know, how on earth did she manage to retain her dignity and her clarity of thought and walk to her death at the end with enormous dignity, so that I think she does leave a legacy for her sons. And as the government said, in the end, she called our bluff.
Yes, 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 she did. Yeah. So do you know what's next? Is there going to be a next after Rosenberg?
Oh, gosh, she's a hard act to follow. I'm so immersed in the politics of this era, and the 1930s, 40s and 50s are the period I love. Well, make a suggestion. I don't have anybody at the moment. I need to process all of this. You'll know it takes a long time talking about your story. So I'm not in a rush to move on, actually, but you need to be so obsessed by your subject. You can't just do something because a publisher suggests it. I think you really have to feel it and want to devote a big chunk of your life to it beforehand. So,
yes, yeah, I agree. And I wouldn't make a suggestion, or to put it another way, even if I made a suggestion, it would only make sense to you if there's something in you, something in your background or your interests. Yes. People often suggest subjects to me, and they're good subjects. And I have to say to them, but I didn't think of it. It sounds a little arrogant, but
I know
it's really true. You can't just pick something because it's subject for a biography.
No, you're completely right. And in the event, it wasn't actually, although I told you it wasn't the thinking about spies that led me to Ethel. It was thinking about New York, where I'd lived as a young mother, but it was that word, being a mother, because I think mothers are often accused of being bad mothers. I've written a book about Winston Churchill's mother, Jenny Churchill, who was always accused of being a bad mother for Winston. Nobody ever looked at his father, Lord Randolph, who was abusive and appalling and never showed any interest to Randolph at all. So I think how you do mothering is utterly fascinating. We don't learn mothering at school, although Ethel tried to be a better mother. And there are so many difficult aspects of being the right sort of mother. But that was really what intrigued me. And that may lead on to some other subject that isn't necessarily a biography. I don't quite know. I'm thinking aloud, which probably is a dangerous thing to do.
Yes, I do it all the time. It is a dangerous thing to do. You've just given readers another reason to read your book, regardless of the sort of the extent or the degree of their interest in Ethel Rosenberg. There's so much here about, as you say, mothering, about family, about how to deal with just, you know, overwhelming circumstances. It's a story of human dignity. It's all these things, I think, which you have an ostensible subject, but in a way you have a deeper subject at the same time, which is what you've just been talking about in terms of her character and her striving. It's a very American story.
Yeah, wanting to be better constantly. Yeah. And trying to juggle all these difficult things in her life. You know, they lived in this very cramped apartment with three rooms. So they gave the biggest room to the two babies, and they slept on a pull-out sofa in the sitting room. You know, it's not impossible. I know families live in worse circumstances in makeshift tents and camps, but it's not easy. And they were losing money with Julius's business that he set up after the war. I mean, so much was stacked against them, really. And she didn't have the support of her own mother. her own mother, who kept urging her to tell lies and not to be so stupid, and it would save her neck. I mean, I think in some ways that too is the saddest part of the story, to have a mother come and visit you when you're in prison under a death sentence and have your mother tell you you're being stupid because you should tell a lie to save your skin. It is a very complex story at many levels.
I think that's a good place to end.
Oh, I can't tell you what a treat it is to talk to another biographer who is so familiar with the problems and how you weigh up the material and how you use it and, you know, one's responsibility to one's subject. All those things are hard to explain to someone who doesn't do it and live with a personality for so long and get under your skin. So it's been such a pleasure for me to hear your insight into all of this.
Well, thank you, Anne. It was a great pleasure and privilege for me to be able to talk to you, and we'll have to do it again sometime.
Well, that may be an offer I can't refuse. Thank you, Carl.
Okay, thank you. I'm about to post this and I will send you a link.
That's absolutely brilliant. Does it just go up as is?
It goes up as is, unless I find some technical problem. But what I like about doing these podcasts is that they are spontaneous. I don't edit you and I don't edit myself.
Well, I look forward to hearing it back. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye for now. Bye.